This week's episode is brought to you in part by Groenfell Meadery, an open-source meadery. Head over to groenfell.com to try their recipes at home or order mead right to your door at groenfell.com/store. Just released this week is the next sour in the Chaos Sour series, Curmudgeon. Curmudgeon is a maple elderberry sour. Ricky says it's one of the coolest, craziest meads he's ever had. And I bet that's saying a bunch. Check it out at groenfell.com/store. That's GroenFell. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 20th, 2020. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby, author of the upcoming book, How to Make Hard Seltzer, joins us to talk about our friend carbon dioxide, a bit about the physics of CO2 and the fermenter and the keg, and how to use it to carbonate and protect our beers. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Steve Wilkes of stevesbrewshop.com and I got together yesterday afternoon to shoot two new video episodes. One of my sizer fermented with bread yeast that I made based on a recipe from the Groenfell Meadery website. They don't recommend bread yeast, but, you'll have to watch the video. It's coming up in a few weeks. And the other is a hoppy IPA that I fermented on my 95-degree Fahrenheit porch using an old pack of Kvikking from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. And even though the pack was more than 4 months old, that yeast was bubbling the airlock within 4 hours of pitching and was chugging along like a freight train by bedtime. Amazing. Well, our friends and sponsors at Imperial have another Kvike offering as a summer seasonal. It's A37 Pog. After years of surviving in cold climates, this Kvike yeast is ready for the tropical lifestyle. When used at high temperatures, Pog produces an extreme amount of tropical fruit aromas, including pineapple and guava. Guava. At the lower end of the range, it's just coffee this morning, I swear. At the lower end of the range, more delicate citrus, peach, and kiwi aromas are noticeable. The beer style options are expansive for this yeast. Use it in a hazy or juicy IPA to complement the hops, or use it in a sour fruited beer to maximize the extreme aromatics. Pog likes to work fast at high fermentation temperatures. It's also strongly flocculant, which makes it great for a fast turnaround. It sounds delicious. You know we love Imperial with the highest pitch rates of any liquid yeast at 200 billion cells. My stir plate is dusty because I don't make starters anymore for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. Ask for A37 Pog at your local homebrew store and check out imperialyeast.com for a full list of what they have to offer. That's imperialyeast.com. Let's take a look into the mailbag, Facebook comments, I guess. If you remember last week, listener Tom wrote into the mailbag saying that he got an excessive amount of bitterness from adding extra hops to a short boil and then doing a no-chill. Well, Will on Facebook had some feedback. Will says, I have a suggestion for the no-chill brewer's question in the beginning of the show. For hoppy beers, I adopted an adaptation of an ice bath once sealed in the cube. I just rack hot into the cube, throw in the whirlpool hops once all the wort is inside, seal the cube, and make sure all the sides have contact with the hot wort to sterilize/pasteurize the cube, then put the cube in an ice bath. I use one of the small plastic tubs meant for holding drinks for picnics and parties and such. I got the idea from hearing Aussies toss them in their swimming pools to chill. Will says, I usually give it a few swirls in the tub while I'm cleaning up. The cube still stays warm for quite a while, but I've gotten under 140 to 150 degrees Fahrenheit in about 30 minutes. So basically just a long whirlpool hop. Huh? Well, there you go. Will says, I also have moved some mid-hop additions to later in the boil to account for the long whirlpool. I've really been pleased with the results. Well, thanks, Will. That's sort of a some chill instead of a no chill, I guess. Kind of a hybrid method. I appreciate your taking time to comment, Will. Always fun to hear another twist on a technique. Let's talk about our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. I spend a lot of time talking about their excellent selection of electric brewing systems, but on highgravitybrew.com, you can also find a wide variety of beer ingredient kits. I'm looking at the homepage of highgravitybrew.com, and I see Doc Brown Imperial Brown Ale, Zeus's Thundor West Coast IPA, and a kit for the Black is Beautiful Imperial Oatmeal Stout. I brewed that recipe, and it is delicious. And if ingredient kits aren't your thing, if you're more independent, the Build Your Own Beer page on highgravitybrew.com is a super easy way to put together ingredients for your own creations. You've got all the ingredients from a very well-stocked homebrew store all on one page, with the total from your order tabulating as you go along and add stuff, always visible at the bottom of the window. Very clever. And, of course, if you're ready to take the pain out of propane, you can browse the extensive selection of electric brewing systems, both High Gravity's Warthog line, which I've got one, I love it, and systems from other manufacturers. High Gravity has you covered. Check it all out at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. Okay, in the latest issue of Zymergy from the American Homebrewers Association, Chris Colby gets down to the basics about carbon dioxide. I talk to Chris about our favorite brewing gas and get a preview of his upcoming book on how to make hard seltzer. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah. We're going to talk about something elemental. But there are elements in it, but there's one element of C and two elements of O.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about our friend carbon dioxide, which is an ingredient of beer that a lot of people don't think about, except for those who are, you know, Reinheitsgebote.
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, I guess we should make it's CO2 is in the news because apparently we're having a shortage of CO2 in the marketplace today because of government regulations relaxing and because of the COVID, there is less ethanol production, and CO2 is apparently a byproduct of ethanol production. And you know, the companies that produce ethanol capture that CO2 and pressurize it and send it out to restaurants and breweries and medical facilities and, you know, all kinds of people who use it. And apparently, according to the news, there is a shortage. So I don't know if people are experiencing that at their local air gas supplier where they get their cylinders for their kegerators or not.
Crazy. Yeah. It's, and as we mentioned earlier, it's sort of the opposite of what we have in our atmosphere. You know, if you could you just had a little machine that, you know, took in air and compressed it and separated the, you know, the nitrogen and oxygen out, you'd have all the CO2 you wanted and it'd be doing some good in the world. But
there
no.
There you go. There's an idea for Shark Tank or something. I don't know. So what are we talking about? What is CO2 and why is it an ingredient in our brewing? What makes it a good companion to beer?
Well, CO2 is carbon dioxide. It's a molecule, as you said, three atoms, one carbon, which is central. It's two oxygens, which are on either side, so it's a linear molecule. It's interesting if you're a chemist. It's unlike water. Water is it's got two hydrogens on a central oxygen, and they're sort of they're not opposite each other. They sort of look like Mickey Mouse ears. In carbon dioxide, it's a linear molecule. So, and it's also double bonded instead of single bonded. So it's at least mildly interesting that two of the most abundant molecules in beer are three atom molecules, you know, very simple molecules. And CO2 is, of course, it's produced during fermentation by the yeast. Yeast take in sugar. In brewer's yeast, it's our maltose, which is split into its component simple sugars, and then it goes through fermentation, which produces carbon dioxide, ethanol, and also heat is released in the end. So that's why CO2 is in beer. It's because yeast give off CO2, and we as humans, as brewers, enhance the amount of CO2, you know, post fermentation, because we enjoy the little, you know, zing it gives to beer. It makes it, you know, a little fizzy, a little prickly. It brings you know, the little bubbles that come out of beer form the foam and help bring the aroma to our nose. And so CO2 is a wonderful, wonderful molecule.
But besides the just the physical aspect of having a fizzy fluid, is there a chemical component to what CO2 brings to the solution? And does it change things once you introduced CO2 into the solution?
Yes, CO2 undergoes a chemical reaction with water. If you dissolve CO2 in water, a very small amount of it forms carbonic acid. And the formula for carbonic acid is H2CO3. So if you remember, carbon was CO2. So carbonic acid is just CO2 plus CO, CO2 plus H2O, right? So now you've got H2CO3. Okay, and carbonic acid can give up one of its hydrogen atoms to form bicarbonate, which is HCO3 minus. So it's, you know, you've taken one of the two hydrogens away, so you're left with HCO3. And given that the hydrogen atom would have, or ion would have had a positive charge, the resulting molecule, which is bicarbonate, has a negative charge. Then that, in turn, can give up its only hydrogen and become CO3 minus 2, and that's carbonate. And so these three chemicals could be in the water as a consequence of CO2 being dissolved in the water. But the interesting thing is they don't, like, all three of them don't form or not in equal amounts. When the pH is low, when it's under 6, almost all of the molecules are in the form of carbonic acid. If the pH is over 11, a very, very high pH, almost all of the molecules are in the form of carbonate. And if it's in between, which is where, you know, water is initially, you know, when you, at the time when you mash in, although afterwards it very quickly shifts to a lower pH, but, you know, you're brewing liquor before you use it is in the middle. And at that point, almost all of that molecule is going to be in the form of bicarbonate. So, these molecules do form the reaction of CO2 and water. An interesting thing, though, is that there's very few of them. Most, you know, by far the bulk of the CO2 just remains as CO2 in solution. And the amount of carbonic acid that initially forms and the subsequent things it can turn into is very, very small.
So it has, CO2 has minimal impact really on the flavor of the beer or the character of the beer, which makes it a good gas to store it under, right? I mean, oxygen is bad because it it causes changes in the character of the beer, but CO2 is beneficial not only just because it comes from the beer itself, but because you can store it under CO2. And your beer will stay fresher longer.
Right. CO2 is relatively inert in water. It forms a small amount of carbonic acid, which will drive the pH down a little bit, but, you know, not so much that the water tastes, you know, sour or anything like that, or the beer in you know, retrospect. And so, yeah, it's a gas that dissolves readily into liquid and into water, at least aqueous liquids like beer. It comes out pretty easily. You know, you don't open your beer and have to wait 3 days for the foam to form. It pops right back out. And it's abundant. It comes right from the microorganism you're already using to brew beer. So it's kind of a happy coincidence that it's also a pleasing thing in a lot of different alcoholic beverages.
And CO2 can remain in solution, say at room temperature, at atmospheric pressure. So even if you've got a beer that's just finished fermenting and it doesn't look fizzy or it doesn't look like it's full of CO2, depending on the temperature and depending on the atmospheric pressure, there may be a pretty good amount of CO2 already infused in there, right?
Yeah, immediately after fermentation, your beer is saturated with CO2. It holds as much CO2 as it possibly can, given that temperature and the atmospheric pressure. You know, assuming that you're not fermenting under pressure other than atmospheric pressure. And at that point, although you do have quite a bit of CO2 dissolved in the beer, if you would taste some, as I'm sure every home brewer has, taste some beer straight out of the fermenter, it still tastes flat because it's not to the usual level of CO2 in beer, which it requires pressure. You know, it requires CO2 to be above the beer and at a pressure that it will supersaturate the solution. That's or at least it'll inside the pressure vessel. Oh, there's my cat. Thank you, Doodle.
Doodle is correcting you in some way.
Yeah. He's like, oh, that's entirely oversimplistic. Can't believe you're spouting this crap. Take a cat, guys.
If you're wanting to carbonate your beer to a certain carbonation level, say 2.5 atmospheres, you want to take into account the temperature of your beer and the amount of CO2 that's already in there. Say if you're calculating how much, say, priming sugar to put in there or how much pressure to put your beer under, in the keg or whatever. You got to keep in mind that there is CO2 already in the beer.
Right. You have to, can't stop. Good. Okay. Doodle, can you give it a rest? There you go. Thank you. You're a good kitty. Yeah. When you carbonate a beer, it helps to know how much CO2 you already have. So you can add enough to get to your target. And with an ale, ales retain less than lagers do because they're fermented at a higher temperature and more CO2 bubbles out. There are, though, including at beerandwinejournal.com, tables where you can look up the temperature that you fermented at, and it'll give you how much CO2 should be dissolved in your beer. And then from there, there's a separate table. This is in the same article at Beer and Wine Journal. And also in the Zymergy article I wrote on this, that tells you how much sugar to add that will ferment into that much carbon dioxide, and you can hit your carbonation target much more accurately that way than just, in the old days it was just, add 3/4 cup of corn sugar, to 5 gallons, and that was, it was both a volumetric measurement instead of a weight, which would have been better, and it was just applied, across the board, and it sort of kind of worked because at that point most people were brewing ales, so you never encountered the lagers where that would have became a problem with overcarbonation.
Yeah, I mean, it gets you in the ballpark for most homebrew, at least of that time.
Yeah, if I'm making just a a quick pale ale and I'm not that overly excited about things, I'll put, I usually use a cup of sugar, and I know at the temperature I've fermented at, it doing that before, I know what level of fizziness that will result in. But you know, if you're interested in calculating it down to like the point whatever in volumes, 2.5 volumes of CO2 versus 2.6, then you'd take a little bit more care to weigh out your ingredient and to consult the tables.
Does Doodle need to be fed or?
No, he just does that before he throws up.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Or sometimes, I don't know. I've never seen him go on like this.
He wants to be a part of the media.
Part of the media. All right. He looks like he's calmed down. I'm sure he'll.
And then the retching starts.
Yeah.
So another thing, we're talking about using CO2 to protect the beer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all this talk, and you have addressed it in the article, about CO2 forming a blanket over the beer. So
right.
if you've got fermentation, like, say, an open fermentation, according to your article, spoiler alert, during active fermentation, CO2 is escaping from the top of the beer. And if you've got a vessel that's got, say, a lip around it, that essentially, creates a space in the vessel above the fermenting beer, as long as that CO2 is being replenished, you do have a blanket of CO2 that is protecting the beer over the beer, right?
Right. If you had, let's say you worked in a brewery with one of those stone fermenters, and you had fermenting beer, and if there's not a breeze in the room, and like you said, there was a lip to trap it. The fact that CO2 is constantly coming out, and additionally the fact that it's forming Kroisen is going to help a lot. It would form. There'd be a gradient of CO2. Where the amount of CO2 like right next to the either the beer or the foam is going to be pretty much close to 100%, and then it's going to get lower and lower as it goes out. If you were to ferment your beer, let's say at home in a food grade trash bucket or something, and you just left it in the middle of it like in a room, and it had a ceiling fan that was blowing on it, then you wouldn't really. It would be, sort of instantly disrupted. But CO2 is going to be a volume of CO2 is going to be fairly stable under a volume of air as long as nothing disturbs it. Over time, all the molecules in the CO2, they're moving around at a variety of speeds described by the Boltzmann distribution, if you're wondering. And same with the air. And they're eventually going to bounce into each other and CO2 is going to leak into the air, and air is going to leak into the CO2, and air is nitrogen, oxygen, and CO2. But all that takes time, so it's a little like you've probably seen experiments before where people take like a water that's colored with one color of food coloring, and then they gently pour a layer of, some other kind of water with another food coloring, and at first there's a bilayer, and then you start to see the two colors start to merge, but even though water is soluble in itself, it just takes time. So the answer to the question that people always ask, does CO2 form a blanket? Yeah, it can under still circumstances. And additionally, if you're getting CO2 from a cylinder, okay, that gas always comes out cold because it's been under a lot of pressure. And, when you if you're really pumping CO2 out of a – or, turn on the valve and a lot of CO2 is coming out of the cylinder, you'll see up around the regulator, it will start to freeze or whatever. So it comes out very cold. And here's the thing. A cold mass of CO2 is going to sink below air at sort of room temperature. And it's going to stick together pretty well for a while, in part because it is cold and the molecules in it are moving much slower. So it takes them longer to start integrating, into the air above it.
So if I'm filling my keg, And I've got an empty keg there. It's nice and clean. It's nice and sanitized. And I've got my tube running from my racking cane or whatever into the bottom of the keg. So if I take a cold blast of a few seconds of CO2 from the from the tank that's hooked up to the keg, that's going to help protect my beer that I'm racking from the fermenter into the keg from oxygen exposure?
It would help. A few seconds might be underdoing it. One thing I know people have done is, and I've done on a couple occasions, you can put, if you have just an aeration stone, you can let it sit for, maybe 30 seconds at the bottom of your corny keg, and then the CO2 is just going to rise up from the bottom and push the air out. Or some people fill their keg with water, then hook it up like you would a beer, and use the CO2 to expel all the water, and then the keg is 100% full of CO2. And yeah, if you rack under that cover of CO2, that'll work, assuming that you work relatively quickly. I mean, the corny keg has got the advantage of it's upright and sort of a thin cylinder, so the it's going to take a while for the gas to start mixing with the air. Like if you fill the keg with water, empty it, and then start racking right away, you'll be fine. If you opened up the keg to CO2, then went ahead to lunch and came back, then it probably would be much less fine, if not useless. But you've got time to work. If you purge a vessel with CO2 and you want to rack in beer under cover of that, and that works to help keep staling down, because oxygen from the atmosphere obviously gets in beer and it primes it. And there's some chemical reactions that occur, and then a later set of chemical reactions occur to make molecules that are flavor active, like trans-2-nonanol and some others. Excluding oxygen by a temporary blanket, quote unquote, of CO2 is a good thing to do.
And I've seen online where brewers have taken the effort to hook up the output of their, their airlock in a an actively fermenting vessel, and putting that into the input of a keg, so that all that CO2 is not just escaping into the air; it's being directed into an awaiting vessel, and that way, you can get free CO2. You can't pressurize a keg with that, because or at least I don't think you can. It would certainly take a lot more effort to get the pressure right and everything. But at least you could take that waste CO2 and put it into a better place.
Yeah, I shook my head no when you answered that. So I don't know if that came across on the audio. But
I didn't hear your head rattle.
Yeah.
About the pressurization, I questioned that was the shake.
Yeah, you're right. You would get CO2 in the keg, but it would be at atmospheric pressure. And you could use it, for later when you rack the beer from the fermenter into there, that would work. But yeah, you would need to cool it down a lot and then have some sort of, device that would condense it under pressure. And that's not at least anything that comes with the standard corny keg.
Now, say I've filled up my keg with my beer, and then I put the lid on and I snap it into place, and so it's all pressurized. Now, now you've got this headspace, depending on how much beer is in there, that has air in it. So you hook up your CO2 and you put it under pressure, and you release the pressure. How many times, in theory, have you got to do that before you get all of the air out, and it's all CO2? There's a thought experiment for you.
Yeah, that's a good one. When you think about it, there's a couple different variables. You've got whatever the headspace is in the top of the keg, and then you've got whatever volume of gas is expelled when you open the pressure release valve. And, ideally, if you could time it so that you pulled the pressure release valve and held it long enough so that the entire volume of gas in the headspace was expelled, that'd be ideal. But of course, you can't, because there's always going to be some gas left in that, although CO2 is coming in. One thing I would say is that I always do it three times. I know that's not a scientific, I haven't experimented to figure it out, but it seems to work pretty good. And I mean, I think the first time you pull the pressure release valve, you've got essentially, you had a volume of gas or a volume of air at atmospheric pressure, slightly compressed due to some CO2 at whatever pressure you've dialed the keg up to. So the first blast you're going to get when you open the pressure release valve is going to be mostly air. And if you release a blast and the volume of that is at least roughly equal to what's in the headspace, you've probably got most of the air out at that point. If you do it a second time, you're going to get a volume of gas expelled is going to be the same, presumably if you hold the pressure release valve the same amount of time, but it'll be less air overall because the mixture will be more CO2 and less air. And then the third time, it should be, at least in theory, a thing of diminishing returns. And for me, in a practical sense, venting it three times has always worked. But then again, by the time I keg beer, it usually gets drank fairly quickly, not the next day or anything, but I like beer. So, I don't have a cold keg of beer. It gets consumed, within weeks at least, if not a couple of months. So, it doesn't stay around to, really have the time to go stale. But, yeah, that's a good question. And you could approach a better answer to it if someone would like hook a balloon over the pressure release valve and sort of say at 30 PSI, quarter second release of the valve yielded, this volume of, you could see how big, how much the balloon expanded and calculate that volume. And, you're venting this much. And if you could figure out, how much is vented relative to the headspace in the keg, you could sort of approach, you could at least do a sort of back of the envelope calculation of what percentage of air you're getting rid of each time, or what amount of air you're getting rid of each time, and just sum those up.
Or just do it three times.
Yeah, or just do it three times.
But there's brewers out there that won't be satisfied with that. Yeah. They're already on it.
Yeah, and now that I mention it, I'm thinking, why haven't I done this before? If I can break something down and make it more science-y, I'm going to opt for that option rather than the simple thing that just works.
So the article that inspired this discussion is in the July-August issue of Zymergy magazine. And you've got here releasing next month. You got a new book. What's up with that?
What's up with that is that someone asked me to write a book, and I did. Goods and services such as writing can be exchanged for monetary considerations.
What?
And then I can buy ramen noodles and subsist on that.
And Mr. Noodle can eat.
Yes.
And wine.
Yeah.
So what's the book about?
The book is on hard seltzer. It's the BA contacted me last year in the middle of writing a different book. And they said, we would like a book on hard seltzer, yesterday, essentially, and so I went and interviewed a lot of people who made hard seltzers and, did some other research, and I wrote a book on how to make hard seltzers. It's primarily aimed at brewers at, brew pubs and small production breweries, but there's, a section of it, a good maybe a third of the book is on brewing them at home, and it's actually possible to make a real nice, credible hard seltzer at home. And then there's some other stuff in there about people who simply enjoy hard seltzers. I'm not sure how many books we'll sell on that account, but breweries are really craft breweries are really sort of all in on the concept because it's, I mean, hard seltzers are selling very, very well. And they, you know, when they came out, a lot of people sort of pegged them like, oh, here's a girly drink for the summer. But, nobody's going to pay much attention to it. But a couple years after that, and it was selling equally well to males and females. It also was pegged early on as like a millennial thing for young, but now it's selling to all age groups. And last year it had been sort of seasonal, peaking in the summer. It's sort of flattened the curve, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's selling well all year. So a lot of breweries are you know, very interested in getting in on that because it, you know, in the sort of very tough times that breweries are facing now, having a profitable product could mean the difference between, you know, staying afloat as a commercial entity or not. So, and then, you know, for homebrewers, if you're interested in making one, if you know someone who likes it, if you like hard seltzer, you can learn. And also, I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm not the hugest hard seltzer fan in the world. but the technical aspects are pretty cool because you've got, you know, I won't completely spoil it, but you've got, you're fermenting something that's not really yeast friendly, and you have to do a lot of things to get the yeast to ferment completely. And then you also have to get them to do it in a way that doesn't completely make an undrinkable beverage. So there's some technical challenges to it. And I think advanced homebrewers with an interest in science will enjoy it and learn from it. And there, you know, maybe even some things you can take and, you know, then apply back to brewing normal beers that might be of interest. So,
yeah, it sounds like a challenge. It sounds fun. And I can't wait. I can't wait to read it. I'm going to figure out how to get my hands on an advanced copy and have you back in a few weeks when the book is out so we can talk about it again.
Cool. Yeah, it's coming out September 7th. And you can pre-order it on Amazon and probably Barnes & Noble, too. I don't know. But I should know, but I don't.
You wrote the book. You did your part.
I wrote the book. Come on. What am I? You wouldn't want me marketing the book. it's not my forte.
Well, excellent. Yeah. It'll give us an excuse to get back together.
Yeah. Sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks again to Chris. Chris's book, How to Make Hard Seltzer, is coming out next month. I can't wait to read it. And we'll have Chris back on to get the lowdown on making some tasty, sparkling stuff. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. Talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well, stay tuned. So long.